We'll get to the Rising in due course,
he says.
The lesson plan isn't set in stone. And anyway, Mhuirish, the war is Irish history. Aside from the fact that the Rising came out of the First World War, many Irishmen fought for the Allies, at the Western Front and elsewhere.
Not according to the textbook, sir,
Cheeker says. The page of his own carefully laminated copy opened to the box giving the breakdown of war dead.
Well, the textbook is wrong in that case.
Yeah, my great-grandfather fought in the war, Daniel Juster says.
There you go,
Howard says to Mhuirish.
I'm sure that many of you have relatives who fought in the war, even if you don't know about it. And those who didn't fight were still affected. The war transformed everything, so I think it's worth spending some extra time on it.
Also, though he doesn't say it to Mhuirish and barely admits it to himself, he feels that keeping himself and the class immersed in the Great War somehow preserves a connection with Miss McIntyre. After class, he finds Ruprecht van Doren and Jeff Sproke waiting behind.
Yes, gentlemen.
There is a brief, tacit interchange between them, as if to decide who should pose the question. And then Ruprecht says carefully,
We were just wondering if you knew anything about the history of Seabrook, the older part of its history?
Like from days of yore?
Jeff Sproke chips in.
That depends,
Howard says.
Whenabouts in yore are you talking about?
Ruprecht meditates on this a moment. Then, once again with some delicacy.
When the world was ruled by some kind of goddess?
And they built these mounds?
Jeff blurts, before he is silenced by a look from Ruprecht. Howard strokes his chin.
Sounds like pre-Christian times. Not really my field, boys, sorry. But what's this about, anyway?
Oh, you know,
Ruprecht says vaguely.
It just seemed interesting to find out more about the place our school is built on top of.
Jeff adds, inspired.
I'll ask around,
Howard says.
And if I find anything out, I'll let you know. Thanks, Mr. Fallon.
They hasten away, deep in discussion. The opacity of the 14-year-old mind. Howard smiles to himself and continues on his way. Opening the door of the staff room, he is greeted by an unusual hubbub. Teachers are thronged around the middle of the room, all talking at once in an uncharacteristically jubilant way. From the periphery, the school secretary, Miss Noakes, turns to Howard.
He's back,
she says, beaming at him as though under the influence of some wonderful drug. The meaning of this is obscure to Howard, but it gives him a bad feeling. His own smile wilting like a neglected houseplant. He squeezes through the knot of bodies to find at its heart, enthroned on the sofa, Finian O'Dolic, the geography teacher.
Not too hard,
he exclaims comically to the colleagues clapping his shoulder.
I've still got stitches.
In his hand is a jar containing something roundish and grey, and approximately the size of a golf ball, which someone behind him tells Howard is his gallstone.
Howard,
O'Dolic spots him. He steps forward, hastily reaffixing his smile.
What do you make of that, Howard?
O'Dolic waggles the jar under his nose.
The doctor said it was the biggest one he'd ever seen.
Really?
Howard coos feebly.
Yes, and he said the gallstone was pretty big too.
The company laughs indulgently, although this witticism is by now on its fourth or fifth outing.
Fantastic,
says Howard through clenched teeth and a thickening glaze of unreality.
So, does this mean we'll have you back at work soon? How long a convalescence are you looking at?
Convalescence be damned,
O'Dolic declares, thumping his chest.
I was bored out my tree lying around there at home watching the grass grow. Doctor says I'm fighting fit. Says he's never seen anything like my powers of recovery. I'm going to convalesce right here, standing on my own 2 feet, teaching geography.
A raucous sally of approval from his colleagues.
Those little so-and-sos won't know what hit 'em.
O'Dolic, enjoying his moment, adds to another cheer. Howard pretends to join in, and when the noise dies down, remarks, as if to himself,
So I suppose that Miss McIntyre won't need to come back after all.
But the name means nothing to the geography teacher. He shrugs, and then launches into a fresh account of his surgery for a new arrival. As for the others, few of them seem to hear him, and those who do merely blink at Howard distractedly, as if he's mistaken them for his pupils, and started spouting on to them about some phantasmal figure from a textbook.
Was your grandfather really in the war, Skip?
He was my great-grandfather, my mum's grandfather. He got his right hand shot off.
Wow.
Dennis performs some internal calculation.
Does that mean you have an ancestor who wasn't a bender?
You know what I am thinking is...
Mario speaks up here.
If you needed to raise an army of zombies, this Western Front would be a good place to go.
Mario, what the hell do you want an army of zombies for?
I don't want an army of zombies. I'm just saying that if you did, a good place to go would be the Western Front, because of all the dead people lying around there from the war.
No, it wouldn't, you stupid wop. They'd all be missing arms and legs and stuff.
Up yours, Hoey. You're the wop. Because FYI, if you die and then you are reanimated, you can attach your limbs back on.
That's bollocks.
It's not bollocks. Everyone knows that.
It's total bollocks.
Well, they could throw the arms and stuff at you.
Mario continues gamely.
With what, Mario? They could throw their arms at you with what? With their mouths? With Il Duce?
But now Skippy's phone bleeps, and the conversation gives way to a shivery of coos and kissy noises, as Skippy, transformed into one giant goofy grin, reaches for his pocket. In the end, it was all so simple. What happened was, Laurie's dad saw her kissing Skippy outside the gates the night of the hop, and he freaked. He thinks she's still too young to be with boys. And he grounded her for 2 whole weeks, and even confiscated her phone. That's why she hadn't replied to Skippy's poem. And she was so sorry because it was so beautiful, and she had missed him so much. At first, Skippy couldn't believe it. When he got that first message, sitting in the basement, it was like a wrecking ball had just crashed through the wall, and he suddenly found himself looking out into the airy night. But he replied... And she replied to his reply, and to the reply to her reply. And though he was sure every message he sent would be the one that brought the whole magical card house tumbling back down again, his phone kept buzzing with her responses, each one a little golden hit that travelled straight to his heart, right through and into today, until it's like they've never been apart. OMG, Irish is so boring, like... What is the point? I'm in religion. It's worse. Our teacher looks like an overweight vulture. Ours is like the little one from Different Strokes, except not so little and not funny. Gross camembert bagel for lunch. What you got? Ricotta. It's like eating heated up wallpaper paste. You're so funny. In class, the phone sits on his lap under the desk, set to silent but lighting up as each message arrives, as if it's just as excited as he is. He tries to remember to keep half an eye on the teacher, because if he gets caught, then his phone'll be confiscated, which would be a disaster. But somehow he can't bring himself to worry. The world going on around him seems so far away, a dim flurry of ghosts. Warm, noisy, coloured-in ghosts.
You won't find the answer staring at your feet.
Mr. Juster, je vous en prie. Wakey, wakey, faggot.
Concentrate, Daniel.
But when's he going to see her? To have her so close and still out of reach is almost worse than the torture of not hearing from her at all. Isn't her dad ever going to unground her? I'm just glad he didn't find out about the drinking and pills. He probably would have sent me off to boarding school. He sounds scary. He's not. I love him. But maybe he thinks all boys are like he was when he was 14. Sorry. You're right. It's my fault. You're grounded. I'm sorry. Don't worry, I won't be here forever, she says. Although, that doesn't feel like much of a consolation right now. And then, midway through science class, after a minor lull, he gets this. I've got an idea, DJ. DJ is what she calls him in texts, as in, last night a DJ saved my life. Why don't you come visit me in my house? Somewhere a trillion miles away, Mr. Farley is telling the class about natural incidents of electricity. Seriously? Why not? They said I can't go out. They never said I can't have friends over. And then they could see what you're really like. Sure, but visit her house, with her overprotective dad who hates him. Okay, and then why not go for a picnic on the North Pole, or swim to Atlantis? It's not a big deal, DJ. You can come after school. You are so sweet. They will love you, and they'll stop worrying. Just come. Bring your frisbee. It will be fun, I promise. Everything will be fine. He lingers over these last words. Everything will be fine. It's been so long since he thought this, since he could even imagine himself thinking it. And now here it is. Everything will be fine. The future, the universe, will be fine. Okay, so how about Friday? Friday's miles away. I can't wait that long. Why don't you just come up tomorrow? I think you know where the house is. And he laughs, like she is right there to hear him laughing.
You find something funny about the term ball lightning, Mr. Juster?
Mr. Farley asks him. Skippy, yanked back those trillion miles, flails around helplessly. But Mr. Farley just smiles and carries on, and it's like the room is filled with sunlight, too bright to see.
Greg, do you have a minute?
Why, Howard?
The automator turns from his window, where he's peering out at the yard.
What are you still doing here?
Yes, I had a...
Scared to go home, that it?
No, actually, I was correcting some,
Just pulling your leg, Howard. Come on in. Always welcome in these parts. On the pale side there, buddy. You feeling all right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I just wanted to ask you about some... Oh, I'm sorry. Has there been some bad news?
News? Oh, you mean this?
The automator glances down at the black armband adorning his shirt sleeve.
No, no. Well, that is to say, yes. As a matter of fact, there has been some news, Howard. And while it's not as bad as it might have been, it's still not what you could call good. Old man's taken a turn for the worse. Doctors say he could slip off at any minute. In fact, they don't really understand how he's still alive.
Oh. Howard bows his head solemnly, trying to think of an appropriate platitude.
I wouldn't give up on him yet, though. If Desmond Furlong goes down, you can bet it's not going to be without one heck of a fight.
He raises his chin, looks sternly into the middle distance.
In the jungle, there are many animals, Howard. Macaws, parakeets, flamingos, those are just the birds. Then you've got your rhinos, orangutans, tapirs, various kinds of reptile, you name it. But there is only one beast that gets to be called the king of the jungle, and that beast is the lion. Lion doesn't get where he is by grubbing for ants or swinging from tree to tree. He lives life on his own terms. He sticks to his guns. When he acts, it's with 100% decisiveness and self-belief. That's why, year after year, when the animals get together to crown their king, they always pick the lion. Because it's those values that mark out a leader, not how good you are at sucking sap out of a tree trunk or using sonar to navigate at night. Desmond Furlong was just such a lion.
He pauses.
What do you think, Howard? Too much?
Howard, in spite of his best efforts, can only goggle like a man in a bell jar.
You're right. Trudy, cut that whole lion part. It's too much.
Trudy assiduously takes a red pen to a printout sitting on her desk.
But I'll tell you this, Howard. Whatever else happens, this Father Desmond Furlong Memorial Concert is going to give the old man exactly the send-off he deserves. We're having the auditions day after tomorrow, though we've pre-selected most of the acts, obviously.
Howard is confused.